This is the weekly podcast from Radio Today. I'm Trevor Dann with a main interview we've been trying to secure for literally ages. He's been here, he's been there, he's been absolutely everywhere. But eventually, we have caught up with BBC Radio's chief football correspondent, their senior football commentator, John Murray. We'll have news and David Lloyd's radio moments as well. But first, on a slightly wobbly Skype line from the media centre at last weekend's Ryder Cup, John Murray told me how he got started in radio.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
The way that I got into this job was through a very formal route. I went to university, then did a postgraduate course in radio journalism, and I ended up getting a job as soon as I finished my postgrad course in at TFM, which was the commercial radio station on Teesside. And I started out doing news and sport, but over the course of the years, specialised in sport, then moved to the BBC local radio station, which was BBC Radio Cleveland at the time, BBC Tees as it is now. And from there, once I'd made my move into the BBC, then moved to BBC National Radio. So it was a very smooth progression, I have to say, when I look back on it now.
So let's talk about the art of commentary. And I say art because I think it is an art as well as a craft. You're faced with that football pitch in front of you, and you know that the audience can't see it, your audience at least can't see it, what is, do you think, your job when the microphone is switched on?
It is a form of broadcast art. That's what I would say it is. The very basic is you want to try and bring the listener to where you are, and that involves the very basic of painting pictures. I think trying to entertain is a big part of it. Another one of the basics as well is making sure they know what is happening, because it is one of the obvious things about radio broadcasting is that anyone can switch on at any time. And what do they want to know? If they've got an interest in this sporting event, they want to know what the score is. That is one of the absolute first things. You have to get the basics right. If you were to put together a list of what would potentially go into the ideal, the perfect football commentary, you could draw up a document of pages and pages and pages of things that could go into it. And I think the more variety, the better. The basic thing, the information, and also giving someone an idea, which is why I love it when we go to far-flung places, because you think, well, it's less likely that people listening will know what it's like here. And therefore, you have a responsibility, I feel, to give them a flavour, give them an idea, give them a picture of what it is and what it's like where you are.
One of the things I'm really interested in is partisanship. I think you and your colleagues, when you go abroad, when you commentate on England, you're clearly supporting England. But many times when you're at a Premiership game, I mean, don't tell me, for goodness sake, whether you're a Newcastle or a Middlesbrough or Sunderland fan or whatever you are, because it won't do your reputation any good. But when you go and you watch your team play, is that hard? Is it difficult to be impartial?
There is not a team that I strongly support, and it's always been like that for me. And I feel that is a really big help to me, because I don't have a vested interest, and therefore I can have a genuinely neutral view. And, you know, don't get me wrong, during the course of the time, you know, over a period of years, there will be teams that you, I hate to use the word favour, you know, there will be teams that you are more favourably disposed to than others because of different factors, whether it is the manager, whether you get on with the manager, whether you like the manager, whether you like the way that the team plays. And this, I'm talking about club teams. And all sorts of other things as well that go into that. I think it's essential to try and remain as neutral as possible and give the balanced view. And I hear what you say. And the Euros this summer was a very interesting example of this, because, you know, for the first time in my experience, it wasn't just England that was there. There was obviously Wales, Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland as well. You know, so there were teams there as well. So you're very conscious of the fact that people who are listening will have a vested interest and support teams other than England. And therefore, I felt there was a greater need to have that neutrality there. When it's England against foreign opposition, again, you have to have the balance. But I think you have to also accept that the majority of people who are listening will be wanting England to win. So there is a balance to be found there. You know, we are not here to be cheerleaders. And you know, this sort of follows on to the Olympics as well. You are there to give a journalistic balance of the event that you're watching. And I think you've got to remember that at all times.
I guess that's going to be a big challenge for you this weekend in Minnesota, isn't it? Because obviously we know how partisan the US crowd are going to be at the Ryder Cup. How do you hold yourself back in that instance?
It is a challenge, definitely. And I remember this from Valhalla, which was the last Ryder Cup that the Americans won, where this can very quickly, when you're on American soil, this can very quickly be quite intimidating because we are out on the course. You know, we are following the matches that we are assigned to as commentators. We are out there on the course within the ropes. So we feel and hear that atmosphere and the things that are being said the same way that the players do. But again, you have to maintain that journalistic integrity. I think it is vital that we do that. And some listeners might not like that. They might not want that. They might want us to be more partisan. I think it's essential to retain that balance, to have the perspective.
You mentioned the word integrity, John, and I want to ask you about the whole business of the interface between sports journalists and sports authorities. And this isn't particularly about the FA or any other organisation or British Cycling or anyone, but there's a difficulty, isn't there, sometimes, almost a conflict of interest that you might have a story that is going to reflect very badly on a particular sportsman or a club, and you want to report it. But then on the other hand, you think, well, if I do report it, I may not get access to those people again, and I need them for my job. How does the BBC, well, you're not speaking for the BBC, how do you deal with that? Because I think there's that pressure is often there.
So what I think is a good example of this, which is not quite a sporting body versus the journalist, but over the time that I was covering England, which was the last 2 years, i.e. from the Brazilian World Cup until the Euros, when I had to deal with Roy Hodgson, who was great to deal with, charming man, you know, on a personal level, when the microphones were switched off, I really warmed to him. And I don't feel that individual really came across to the watching and listening public. And therefore, when things went very badly wrong for Roy Hodgson, I found that seriously quite a challenge to be as critical as perhaps I needed and wanted to be in the light of what happened. This is what I say about constantly learning lessons doing this job and new challenges that come along, in that I've not found it difficult in terms of dealing with organizations. It's more the individual. It's a strange one. In journalism, as you'll know, it is very important to get to know the individuals, get to know the sportsmen, the coaches, the managers. But at the same time, once you get to know someone, there is that personal connection between you and them. And it is an inevitability in sports journalism that at some point you're going to then have to criticize them. I find it a good deal easier to criticize someone when I don't have a personal relationship. And, but that is one of the challenges of sports journalism and sports broadcasting, that you do have that relationship that other journalists, news journalists, will not necessarily have in most cases.
It's funny, isn't it, that when you meet sportsmen off the mic, they have often got some brilliant stories to tell you. This certainly happened to me in my time running a BBC local radio station. I would sit with people like Garth Crooks or John Gregory, and I would hear riotous stories about other people who were their colleagues in football. You'd switch the mic on, they were not going to tell any of those stories.
Nope. No, I mean, I could give you some great examples this week from two of the guys who are going to be working with us this week, Des Smith and Fred Funk, who you know, have been right there in the thick of the Ryder Cup. And already this week, we've already heard stories from them where we're already saying, are they going to be prepared to say that on air or not? And I suppose that's what you want. But again, you know, it comes back to the personal relationships that they've got with the people that they know and whether they're prepared to tell these stories and to say these things on air. I suppose there are ways of doing it, aren't there? And that's what we'll be encouraging them to do, you know, perhaps to tell the stories where you don't necessarily name the people involved. As journalistically, we want to hear those stories, don't we?
We do. John, back to commentary. Do you, like me, get frustrated with television football commentary? The gabbling they do on the basis of wanting to tell us what we can already see?
Yeah, I do. I think that things have changed quite dramatically, haven't they, in terms of television football commentary to how it is. And of course, now these days, you know, we quite often see on, you know, recorded programmes and recorded football matches from the past where you see a very different style of commentary. But I'm afraid that is the way that it's gone. And, you know, in my experience of TV football commentary, on a couple of occasions, I've actually been told by the people who are editing and producing back at base to say more, which has always really surprised me, because I, like you, I think, well, really, I feel TV commentary should be putting the caption to the pictures that you see, a little bit like in a newspaper, some brilliant photographs, but the caption underneath can be all important as well. And I feel when I do the TV football commentary, which admittedly is only a fraction of the time that I work, that's what I want to do. But increasingly now, you will find that the TV executives want not just one expert summariser alongside the TV commentator, but two of them. If you have two people, two former players, managers, sitting alongside a commentator, it is inevitable that there is going to be a conversation going on as opposed to a commentary.
In your experience talking about those expert so-called summarisers, does the producer ever take them on one side and say, could you stop saying he's not going to like the look of that on Match of the Day, or yeah, you know, the important thing now is to score a goal because they're 2-0 yeah, down. But those kind of cliches, I would think as a commentator, they must annoy you as much as they annoy us as the listener.
Yeah, this is something that has changed quite dramatically in the time that I've been working at the BBC. I remember David Pleat saying to me probably 10, 15 years ago that as footballers, managers, players, he said, in the football business, they're being told what to do in the days leading up to matches, the day of the match, half time in the match. That's what they get. That's how they work, being told what to do. And he said to me, when you move into broadcasting, no one tells you what to do. And you just have to find your own way. But I think that's changed. And we have people who, when we begin to use new summarizers who've not done it before, we have people we send out now and have sessions with them. You know, we'll tell them and make it clear to them what is expected of them. And similarly, I always, if there's someone I've not worked with before, if we're able to meet beforehand, but certainly if we're at the ground, it's essential, I feel, to sit down with them and talk to them and tell them what I want. And yes, I know we have producers who will highlight that if there is a phrase or a form of words that is being used and repeated, they will tell them, and that has changed, I feel.
Well, John, we're very grateful to you for spending so much time, and I wish you well at the Ryder Cup. On everyone's behalf, will you go up to anyone who shouts, "Get in the hole!" and give them a good slap?
I'm not sure that I would be able to completely cover the field of all of the people who do that here. Yes. I think that might be too big a job.
I'm sure you're right. John Murray, BBC football correspondent and temporarily golf commentator at the Ryder Cup. Thank you for talking to Radio Today.
Thanks, Trevor.
Broadcast by Onyx. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
News now from Radio Today's Stuart Clarkson.
Thank you, Trevor. And after all the rumours, Helen Bowden has confirmed her retirement plans this week. The BBC's director of radio will leave the corporation in March after 34 years. James Purnell takes over responsibility for radio from the end of October. He'll head up a division combining radio, arts, music, learning and children's. The BBC will recruit a new director of radio to run things day-to-day under James Purnell. Another big retirement from the BBC this week as well. Radio 2's Desmond Carrington will do his last show for the station at the end of the month. after 35 years. He was first heard on BBC Radio 70 years ago, 1946. He was on a radio drama. He was also on Radio Luxembourg and BBC Radio's Movie Go Round series in the 40s and 50s and joined Radio 2 in 1981. Sounds of the 50s with Leo Green takes over Desmond's Friday night slot until the end of the year. Also leaving the BBC, John Holmes, who's been dropped from the next series of Radio 4's Now show after 18 years on it. The Talk Radio Afternoon host says he was told they wanted to recast the topical show with more women and diversity. Suffolk's DAB Multiplex launches this week from Muxco, as well as the county's BBC local radio service, Heart, Smooth and Fun Kids. There'll also be two country music stations, Chris Country, and a new service from Lynx FM Group called Suffolk First. Two Scottish stations, Heartland FM in Perth and Wave 102 in Dundee, have asked Ofcom if they can merge. The regulator's running a consultation before making the decision. That would see Wave's programmes all appear on Heartland, which itself previously took over the Perth licence to add to its original Pitlochry and Aberfeldy area. Sadie Nine has taken over breakfast on BBC Essex following the departure of James Whale. She's replaced on mid-mornings by Ronnie Barber. Wire Free Productions, run by Matthew Bannister and Hussein Husseini, has been commissioned to make Five Live's new Sunday evening programme, reuniting Peter Allen and Jane Garvey. It'll start from the 13th of November, replacing The Hit List. And East Yorkshire community station West Wolds Radio has closed down this week, saying it can no longer fulfil its Ofcom key commitments. It only launched last November, but says it didn't have enough volunteers to keep it going. And those are this week's big stories from radiotoday.co.uk. I'm Stuart Clarkson.
Broadcast Bionics brings you Phone Box, Oasis, Virtual Director, and many more innovative solutions for creative radio people. Come to bionics.co.uk and find out more.
David Lloyd, Radio Moments.
No matter how hard you plan your launch day, things do go wrong. Metro had the tape at the wrong speed. Piccadilly's first song wowed in.
I love the colourful clothes you wear.
Pennine got the wrong report on that first bulletin.
I'm sorry, we had the wrong cart there. That was Bob Scully, who's the British Steel Corporation's chief executive, explaining why the blast furnacemen are going to arbitration.
Plymouth Sound couldn't track down the first baby born on launch day.
Oh, dear, well, never mind. These things are bound to happen. That's what the first day is all about. We will not worry about it. The time on Plymouth Sound is now...
And then this week in 74...
Well, it seems these little things are sent to try us slightly on the very first morning of a new radio station, but what we would like to say most certainly is that, above all, Radio Hallam is a nice friend to have.
The launch of Radio Hallam this week, 42 years ago. The 90s should have been a great time to run a bright, young music radio brand across the UK, but for Matthew Bannister, life at Radio 1 was to prove a little more challenging. He began his duties this week in 1993. He was determined.
Well, of course, there is a lot of competition coming along for Radio 1, and we must be aware of that. But my main aim is to maintain this radio station with 18 million listeners a week as the most popular pop and rock music station in the UK. And we need to go forward. We need to maintain its commitment to new ideas, to new talent, and we need to take that forward with the listeners. As long as Radio 1 continues to focus on the best ideas, the most exciting programmes, the new talent, the new music, then Radio 1 has got a fantastic future as a major cornerstone of the BBC.
Matthew Bannister, who sat at his Radio 1 desk for the first time this week 23 years ago. And Matthew reminded me recently, actually, that he kept more presenters than people think he did, including this one, who'd hosted his first Radio 1 show this week in 67.
One of the most incredibly beautiful records, I think. Top Gear will be bringing you all the best artists and the nicest sounds around. But that is one of the nicest you'll ever hear. By Nirvana, it's called Pentecost Hotel.
And here, live from the Top Gear studio, the Pink Floyd and a song called Set the Controls. Are the controls set? Someone's nodding in the other room. It means they are, so I guess we're all right.
Yes, we were all right. The voice of Peter Drummond appearing there with John Peel on John's first show on Radio 1. It was called Top Gear. And this week, 21 years ago, John hosted his first Saturday morning programme on Radio 4. It was then called Offspring, later evolving into Home Truths. Here's a biggie. Woman's Hour is 70 this week. The first presenter was a bloke. He lasted 3 months. Norman Collins was controller of the Light programme, which is where Woman's Hour lived back then. He explained to Marjorie Anderson what it was all about.
I always visualised the poor, wretched housewife, her morale probably at the lowest, round about 2 o'clock in the afternoon when she had the washing up and lunch to do. And, of course, one of the great advantages of radio as against television is that you can do other things and listen at the same time. And I thought it would be pleasant idea if we arranged for a programme, roughly an hour, in which there wouldn't be simply an endless succession of light music, but we would have speakers talking on those topics which would be of interest to intelligent women. And the whole thing I want to emphasise here is the intelligence of the woman, because I really do think that you'll find a large number of programmes in which intelligence of the listener as a whole is underrated, and for some reason or other, particularly, the intelligence of the woman is underrated.
A huge happy birthday to the famous Woman's Hour, that programme of roughly an hour. It's changed channels and timing, but it's still there, 70 years on. For a time, GWR was the group owning more stations than anyone else, forging ahead with consolidation with enviable efficiency. The GWR name was born this week, 31 years ago.
You know all these people who've stayed tuned to this frequency?
Yep, through thick and thin.
What can we do to thank them?
How about giving them radio 24 hours a day?
Hey, yeah, they'd really like that. After all, life goes on 24 hours a day. Why can't radio?
Well, it means we could give them even more of what they want to hear.
What? More local and national news?
Yeah.
More local people talking about themselves?
Right.
More community involvement?
Don't you just love the questioning tone from those voiceovers? What? You mean exactly what you've just said? Yes, I do. The early breaths for GWR, which began this week in 85 as Wiltshire Radio and Radio West came together. And the year before that, commercial radio arrived in Kent.
Good morning, I'm Colin Maitland, and on behalf of everyone at Invictus Sound, I welcome you to another day's broadcasting. You can hear Invictus Sound on 603 and 1242 kilohertz in the medium wave and in VHF stereo. You can hear Invictus right throughout Kent, and we hope that you'll stay with us throughout the day and indeed throughout the week. I'll be back with Daybreak after the news.
Hello, Invicta, this week in 1984. It's now Heart. And that same year was this.
And whilst lots of radio stations try to be local, we feel that to produce that distinctive local flavour isn't just a question of doing local news and phone-ins. If something is worth saying, we'll say it. We'll be both responsive and responsible, but we won't patronise and we won't be too parochial.
Good morning, my name is Nick Risby. Welcome to the brand new sound of Radio Broadland.
Do you know, I can still remember every single word of that opening link. It was scripted for me, and the amount of times we had to rehearse it and rehearse it and rehearse it. Mike Stewart, who was our program controller, and I'm sure all the other guys will agree, taught us all just so much about broadcasting.
Radio Broadland launching from Norwich this week in 84. Desert Island Discs is said to be the longest-running factual programme on radio, and this week we celebrate Kirsty Young's 10th anniversary as programme host.
My castaway this week is artist and writer Quentin Blake. For more than 50 years, his work as an illustrator has brought to life the characters and fantastical happenings in some of our most treasured children's books. His style is, in itself, almost a definition of childhood.
Congratulations to Kirsty Young on 10 excellent years on an evolving Desert Island Discs programme. She's some way to go, though, to Roy Plumley's record. He presented it for more than 40 years. Peter Allen is much loved on 5 Live, and this week, 2 years ago, he said goodbye to his last drive after 16 years.
Good evening, 6 o'clock, welcome to Drive with Caroline Barker and Peter Allen. I'm in Datchet in Berkshire, where the floodwaters have... I do apologise. I'm going to have to ask you to take this over, Caroline. I've lost my script.
No, trying situation, of course, in Datchet...
I'm going to talk now about sewer strumming.
Pardon?
Something like that, anyway. I was told to roll the R's. It's just the way I walk. Sorry.
Farewell, Peter Allen from 5 Live Drive this week in 2014. So, with Kenny Everett's first show on Radio 2 35 years ago...
She's responsible for two-thirds of the consumption of milk in the United States and cycles everywhere throughout Hollywood on a bicycle.
The launch of Real Radio in South Wales 16 years ago...
This station is above all about real music.
BBC London 94.9 becoming Radio London this week last year.
And from today, we're again known by the name we launched under on the 6th of October 1970.
And BBC 7 changing its name to BBC Radio 7 8 years ago.
BBC Radio 7.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
David Lloyd's
Radio Moments.
Thank you, David Lloyd, and what a pleasure it was to be back in his and my hometown this week. They had me on BBC Radio Nottingham for an hour with John Holmes. No, not that one. So that's it for now. It's been a TDC production, editing as well as research this week by Hayley Hayes. You can keep up to date on Radio Today's online station in radio in the meantime, and we'll be back next week.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.